The following message was given at Grace Community Church in Minden, Nevada.
All right, well, we're going to start a new book of the Bible. I love starting new books of the Bible. I love introductions. I love background. I love the historical background to the books. As you might know, sometimes these introductions end up kind of spanning out a little bit more than we originally intend. But does anybody remember how to remember all of the old or the minor prophets? What's that? Yes, it's something weird. It's something I learned in Zambia. I've taught Old Testament prophets in Zambia a number of times now. And one of the men teaches, I give him 5 minutes to teach the class how to memorize the minor prophets. It's Hojo, Ojo, Mina, Haze, Haze, Ma. That. Now, it's pretty easy to remember, yeah. Once you get that down, then you have to remember what the first two letters are for everything, which, of course, the older you get, this may not be an effective mnemonic device. All right, well, let's go ahead and turn to the book of Hosea. And we're just going to read the opening verse. And then we'll flip over to chapter 11. The word of the Lord, which came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, during the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, that would be Jeroboam the second. Then chapter 11. When Israel was a youth, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. The more they called, the more they went from them. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and burning incense to idols. Yet it is I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them in my arms, but they did not know that I healed them. I led them with cords of a man, with bonds of love, and I became to them as one who lifts the yoke from their ways. I bent down and fed them. They will not return to the land of Egypt, but Assyria. He will be their king, because they refuse to return to me. The sword will whirl against their cities and will demolish their gate bars and consume them because of their counsels. So my people are bent on turning from me, though they call them to the one on high, none at all exalts him. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I surrender you, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboim? My heart is turned over within me. All my compassions are kindled. I will not execute my fierce anger. I will not destroy Ephraim again, for I am God and not man, the Holy One in your midst. I will not come in wrath. They will walk after the Lord. He will roar like a lion. Indeed, he will roar, and his sons will come trembling from the west. They will come trembling like birds from Egypt and like doves from the land of Assyria. And I will settle them in their houses, declares the Lord. Ephraim surrounds me with lies and the house of Israel with deceit. Judah is also unruly against God, even against the Holy One who is faithful. So we come to the book of Hosea, and just a some things to know, things to remember about interpreting or reading any prophetic book. There's a few different things that are absolutely crucial. The first is you have to know the covenantal background to the prophets. And what I mean by that, and we've taught extensively on this over the years, to understand the covenantal background of the prophets entails a number of things. First of all, the prophets were not just like fortune tellers. They were not just telling the future all the time. They weren't soothsayers. They actually were covenant enforcers, right? They were covenant prosecutors. And the reason the covenant is the background to the prophetic ministry is because the blessings and the curses of the covenant actually form both the judgment and the salvation oracles. In other words, it's the curses of the covenant that form the very basis of the oracles of judgment, and it is the blessings of the covenant that actually then form the oracles of salvation. And so what we're going to see is that every prophet, by the way, major prophet, minor prophet, doesn't make any difference. They rely on the Mosaic covenant for their ministry, right? So they're covenant enforcers against a people, Northern Kingdom and Southern Kingdom, who have broken the covenant, all right? And so one of my favorite Old Testament scholars is a guy named Douglas Stewart, and he has a commentary on Hosea. He says, understanding the message of the book of Hosea depends upon understanding the Sinai covenant. The book contains a series of blessings and curses announced for Israel by God through Hosea. Hosea's task was simply to warn that Yahweh intended to enforce the terms of his covenant. Let me read that sentence again. It's important. Hosea's task was simply to warn that Yahweh intended to enforce the terms of his covenant. And so he says, Israel was continuing a history of covenant breaking, and her Lord had determined to move against his people by unleashing the punishments specified in the law. All right. And so that's the first thing. As we read Hosea, we're going to read it against the backdrop of the Mosaic covenant, against the curses of the covenant, the blessings of the covenant, and see actually the way in which the oracles, the prophetic oracles, are shaped by those, by that foundation. The next thing in reading the prophets is actually to know the historical setting of the prophetic book. So you, when you come to a prophet, you should know, was he a prophet for the Northern Kingdom or was he a prophet for the Southern Kingdom, right? By the way, the rise of the prophetic ministry as we know it in Israel's history, doesn't really emerge fully until the kingdom is divided. Okay? And so that what that means is that you have Northern Kingdom prophets and you have Southern Kingdom prophets. And so you have to know which kingdom they're originating. Now, sometimes they're going to deal with both. Sometimes they're going to focus on one or the other. I'll show you that in a second. It's also helpful to know what kings reigned during that time. Why is that important? Well, because we have Kings and Chronicles that actually gives us the historical background of those various kings' reigns. And it is actually that historical background that helps us understand. In a sense, it locates the prophet's ministry historically. Okay, so just humor me for a second. Let's say we were the nation Israel, and we had prophets. Would there be a difference, let's say, in a prophetic ministry during Ronald Reagan's term as president versus Obama's reign as president? Okay. Right, that would shape part of the ministry, wouldn't it? Right. Same thing is true with the Old Testament prophets. You have to know most very specifically what were the external threats that were present during that prophet's ministry, right? So, of course, Assyria, Egypt, Babylon. You have to know what the external threats were. You also have to then understand what the internal threats were. The internal threats, of course, would be in terms of typically national sins. All right? And those national sins end up getting repeated over and over and over again. In a real sense, to speak broadly, the sins, so the internal threat to the nation, would basically be sins against the first great commandment, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. So if that was the first major issue, what would be the first major sin? Well, idolatry, right? So if you're called to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, you'll have no other gods before me, right? One of the major sins that the prophets deal with is going to be idolatry. And as we're going to see in this book, idolatry is likened to adultery, all right? But then there's a second major category, and that would be dealing with the second table of the law, which is to love your neighbor as yourself. So then the sins of the nation, the internal threats to the nation's stability and well-being, would be sins of oppression, sins of injustice, sins of taking advantage of the poor. And what is amazing is that oftentimes during Israel's most prosperous eras, either northern or southern kingdom, it is during their most prosperous eras where they actually are the most guilty of exploiting the poor. All right. Now, let me just say one quick thing about this, and that is I absolutely resent the social justice movement because there is a true biblical social justice. Okay? God is furious when people exploit the poor. And God is furious when people oppress the weak. And God is furious when people take care of widows and orphans. And the Old Testament nation, and I would also argue the New Covenant Church, has a moral responsibility to help the weak, the poor, the oppressed, the widows, and the orphans. And what I resent about the social justice movement is that it robs genuine justice. It's hijacked it with all of this woke nonsense that at the end of the day is not biblical justice. All right? So we'll only cover that 46 more times. All right, so you got to know the internal threats, the external threats, the prevalent sins. You have to know where the prophet fits. And here's the most important part historically. Where does the prophet fit in relationship to the exile? Is he a pre-exilic prophet? Is he an exilic prophet? Or is he a post-exilic prophet? Okay. I would argue that you actually cannot understand the prophetic book in its fullness unless you understand its relationship to the exile. All right? Do they come before? Are they in it? Are they themselves exiles or are they post-exiles? And so you can see that nifty chart I put there for you so that you can go back to it again and again. And so you have your pre-exilic prophets, prophets before the exile. And of course, to Israel. Now, is the Northern Kingdom's exile that happens when? With the Assyrian invasion of 722. All right. Southern Kingdom's massive exile, which takes place over a period of four deportations, and then finally the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, happens in 586 BC. All right. But understanding, so you have these pre-exilic prophets, that's just prophets before the exile, and you have two to the northern kingdom in particular, Amos and Hosea. And then you have a whole multitude to Judah, which would be Joel, Isaiah, Micah, Zephaniah, Jeremiah, Habakkuk, and we throw Lamentations in there because it's connection with Jeremiah. Then you actually have two prophets that prophesy during the exile, which is, of course, Daniel and Ezekiel. And then you have prophets who prophesied after the return, all right? And that would be Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. You then have three prophets that actually prophesy to nations explicitly outside of Israel and Judah. You have two that prophesy against Nineveh, Jonah and Nahum, and then one against Edom, which is a single chapter of Obadiah. All right. So understanding. So what we would say is just simply locating the prophet historically, where he fits, what were his times, right? But then also, where did he fit in terms of in reference to the exile? Absolutely critical background to know. Now, that brings us to the location of the minor prophets in Hebrew Bible. Now, this chart, which I put out for you, I would love it if one of these times Daniel and Charlie and I just took a month, just a week of Wednesdays, and actually went over this, because this is amazing. So, you know, in Hebrew Bible, the order of the books, the canon, is different than English Bible. All right. And sometimes we end up kind of missing some cool things. So I'm not going to do this in detail. But if you notice, first of all, you've got Torah. Torah is going to be the first five books of the Old Testament. Torah ends up being foundational to everything else. By the way, Torah is foundational to the New Testament. Okay? The coming of Jesus Christ doesn't make sense apart from Genesis 1 through 3, for instance, right? So Torah is the foundation to everything else, to all further revelation. And so then the book of Deuteronomy, the last book of Torah, actually ends with the expectation of a new Moses, right? So what's happening in Torah is you start with Genesis, which is in the beginning, and you have this progress of history among Israel, right? So it's historical. It's unfolding historically. Then you get to the prophets, right? So you've got Torah, okay? And then you've got the Nevi'im, that is the prophets. And in Hebrew Bible, the prophets are divided into two categories, former prophets and latter prophets. And when you see who makes it in the former prophets, you'll be surprised. Former prophets end up being Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. Okay? Now, what happens in those four books, and by the way, Samuel and Judges are just one book in so Samuel, it doesn't go 1st, 2nd Samuel, it's just Samuel, and then the same for Kings, it's just Kings. All right. But what happens is the former prophets actually then continue to advance the storyline. Okay? That is, they continue to advance the unfolding of Israel's history. And so the book of Joshua, which is, of course, the first book of the former prophets, begins with Joshua, who does what? Who's meditating on Torah. Right? You know, Joshua chapter 1, right? And so God tells him, you meditate on this law day and night, you'll have success, right? So then that ends up, so there's a progression, in a sense, from Genesis to the end of Kings. Then, in Hebrew Bible, there's the exile. So Kings ends with exile, and at the exile, there's a break in the storyline, all right? And so that break in the storyline is now going to be a series of books. Just think of it this way, a series of books that now give commentary to the whole storyline. All right? But commentary in different ways. So you have the latter prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the 12. Okay? And how does, by the way, so you've got, in a sense, four prophetic books. All right? Not 16. We'll talk about that in a second. You've got four prophetic books. And then the last prophetic book, that is the book of the 12, ends with the expectation of Elijah, who's going to come. All right. So Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the book of the 12 is giving prophetic commentary and insight into the story that's just unfolded. All right. Does this make sense? So this would be like having all of your history class, and you're just, in a sense, going through the facts. And then you start to get to those who have the wisdom and the insight, who understand what just happened. OK, so that's what the prophets are doing. Then you have the writings, and the writings begin with Psalms. So how did the Psalms begin? With the blessed man who meditates on Torah day and night. Okay? You're starting to see the way this kind of gets hung together. And so you got Psalms, Job, Proverbs, Ruth, Song of Songs, Ecclesiastes, Lamentations, and Esther. And so you continue on with the writings in Hebrew, the Katavim, and it is prophetic commentary, okay, but then personal commentary. Where would personal commentary come in? Well, primarily the Psalms, right? You understand why, right? So the psalmists are actually expressing, in a sense, not necessarily history, although there are some historical psalms. What they're doing is they're actually making, as it were, inspired commentary on the life of the children of God as either pre-exiles or exiles or even post-exiles. Okay? And then you have wisdom commentary, right? And of course, wisdom commentary would be our wisdom books, all right? And so then the storyline resumes with Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Chronicles. Chronicles is the last book of the Hebrew canon. And it's the last book of the Hebrew canon for a very good reason. Okay. It ends with a son of David captive in a foreign land who then is elevated to the position of being given clothes by the king and allowed to eat at the king's table. That's how Second Chronicles ends. So who else could you say was from Israel, was a captive in a foreign land, and then was exalted to actually sit with the king? Okay, Joseph. Joseph. And what does Joseph end up doing? Joseph ends up saving the nation, right? So Second Chronicles, or just Chronicles, ends with a son of David in captivity, but exalted. And so there's this sense of anticipation. Okay? Even though the storyline has come to a close, the story's not over. By the way, you have to understand that if a Jewish person looking at the Old Testament, looking at their book, it is a book that's unfinished. There's no end to the story. It ends in the most miserable way, in captivity, with a glimmer of hope. But what of that hope? They would have to say that it ended with a glimmer, but not the hope. And so you've got this wonderful sense of the storyline, commentary on the storyline, and then the storyline resuming. Now, when you get to the minor prophets, you've got 12 minor prophets. But when you look at Hebrew Bible, the minor prophets are just the book of the 12. Okay? Now, let's talk about that for just a second. 12 minor prophets that make up one book. Do you have any other books of the Bible where you have a number of books that make up one book? Think about it. The Psalms. Right. The Psalms. So is the Psalms one book? Yes. How many divisions are there in the Psalms? Five. By the way, is that an accident? No. What else has five divisions? Torah. Okay. So, by the way, this is more fun than a human being should be allowed to have. I'm just telling you. Okay. Now, so you have the 12, but you have 12 books. Now, how do we know that in Hebrew Bible that they actually believed that the 12 was actually one book? Well, there was a cool thing that they did in Hebrew Bible. Okay. And that is that the scribes, so this is in the Hebrew text, the Masoretic text, the scribes would actually go through the books of the Old Testament, and they would find the center of the book. Okay? They would identify the middle verse of every book, and they would do it with just simply a little mark. Okay? You have that little mark in Isaiah 33:21, which, guess what, is right dab smack in the middle of Isaiah. You have this little mark in Jeremiah 28:11, which happens to be what? The middle verse of the book of Jeremiah. And then you have it in Ezekiel 26:1, which happens to be the middle of the book of Ezekiel. And when you get to the minor prophets themselves do not have that center verse mark, but rather the center verse mark is in Micah 3:12. Why? Because Micah 3:12 is the middle verse of the minor prophets. All right. You also have what would be called themes. So the way that the minor prophets are arranged may seem haphazard. They're not. There are these seams. There are these little connections. Sometimes they're verbal connections. So, for instance, Joel ends with the Lord roaring from Zion. Amos begins with the Lord roaring from Zion. So you have these connections or these seams of how the books would fit together. Okay. Now, every book stands on its own, or as Bunyan would say, every tub on its own bottom. All right. So there's a sense in which, yes, we come to the book of Hosea, right? And we understand that book has its own title, but it is a part of the book of the 12. All right. So what are we looking for, therefore, when we come to the minor prophets and we go, oh, well, from a Hebrew Bible perspective, it's one book. Well, what do we look for? We look for coherence and unity in the book. Okay, that is coherence. By the way, that's not just for the book of the 12. Okay? That's for the whole Bible. Right. Do you look for coherence and unity in the whole Bible from Genesis to Revelation? The answer is, of course. On what basis? I thought the Bible was 66 books written by 40 authors over a period of 1500 years. Is that not true? By the way, Bruce Ware talked about this three times this weekend. All right. So you might want to know the answer to this. So 66 books, 40 authors. And yet, do we really have? Let me ask it in a way that doesn't seem like a trick question. No, let me ask it in a way that seems like a trick question. So do we really have 66 individual books? Yes. Do we really have over 40 human authors? Yes. Do we really have one book? Do we really have one author? Yes. So that is That is where the coherence and the unity comes from, is that the Bible is ultimately a book of one author. Okay? And Bruce did such a great job of explaining that this weekend. If you didn't hear it, you should listen to it. But then there's something else that brings coherence and unity to the minor prophets, and that is that each one of them play their own part in the unfolding of the storyline, or if you will, the unfolding of redemptive history. Right? Each one plays a significant part, and so it is. It's actually a wonderful example of the one and the many. You have one message, right? You have one overarching message, but you have a multitude of as it were, in a sense, sort of sub-messages, right? That all do what? That all feed into the one message. Same thing with the prophets. You've got these 12 minor prophets, and what do? They all feed in to the one overarching story. So, I find that incredibly exciting, all right? Think of the 12, parallel with the Psalms works, but think of the book of the 12 as also an anthology. And did anybody get an anthology when they were a junior in high school? Did you guys go to school in Tonopah or what? You got an anthology? Okay. I did too. You know what I remember about that anthology? Jonathan Edwards, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And yours too. Okay. Nathan and I graduated about a year apart from each other. An anthology would be what? It's a collection of, it could be a number of things. It could be poems. It could be sermons. It could be essays, right? All from, let's say, you have American literature anthology, right? So in other words, the collection fits into one anthology, but it gives you different perspectives, right? I'd say that's what the book of the 12 does. It's like a prophetic anthology, right? You end up having all of these different camera angles by the 12, and what does it do? It gives you ultimately one big, beautiful picture. Okay, so if you aren't absolutely thrilled by now, I can't help you. All right. All right, so let's move on to introduction to Hosea. So Hosea itself is one of the earliest prophets. Now, when I say prophets, I have to specify, don't I? Because Moses was a prophet, right? Elijah and Elisha were prophets. But when we're talking about Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the 12, we're talking about the writing prophets or the canonical prophets. All right? Hosea ends up being one of the earliest of the canonical prophets. And so there is a little debate on the dates. It could be that Joel is the oldest. Some argue he is, some that he's not. Amos and Hosea are probably contemporaries, but with Amos being a little older. All right. So their ministry overlaps. So Hosea is either the second or third of the oldest canonical prophetic writings. All right. His ministry was primarily in the northern kingdom. Now, is it possible for a northern kingdom prophet to ever address the southern kingdom? Of course, they do it all the time. But there's, in a sense, a primary focus. And so his ministry is in the northern kingdom. So Bible quiz time. What can you tell me about the northern kingdom? Terrible. That was Jeff Eschen's answer for posterity's sake on the recording. Terrible. That is true, Jeff. If I was giving you points, it'd be a half a point for that observation. Anything else? Northern Kingdom. Okay, Matt? Okay. Yeah, so their batting average is, they're zero on the season, okay? Don, you said? Okay, so you've got 10 tribes to the north. Why do we divide north and south? Yep. Civil War. Okay. You remember what happens. Solomon dies. David Solomon, that's the golden age of Israel's history. Okay. Solomon dies, and he has a son, Rehoboam. Okay. Rehoboam should have spent more time reading his dad's books. All right. Rehoboam is an absolute idiot. So Solomon dies. The people come to Rehoboam, and they say to Rehoboam, make our burden easier than your father did, and we will serve you with gladness. And so Rehoboam, being the bright bulb that he was, he went to his father's advisors. And what did his father's advisors tell Rehoboam? Yeah, lighten the burden, right? Lighten the burden. The people will serve you with gladness, all right? In a sense, just, by the way, is that not just wisdom? Just be nice, right? Lighten it up a little bit for them. Show some kindness, right? So kindness is really underrated, isn't it, right? And so just be kind and lighten that load. And so Rehoboam ponders, and he says, oh, wow, so my father's advisors were advisors to the wisest man on the planet. Boy, I bet you I should listen to them. No, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go talk to all the snotty-nosed kids that I grew up with. I'm going to get my advice from my peers. All right? So let me just say, Rehoboam is, at this point, officially a fool. Okay? His buddies tell him, don't be such a wimp. What you need to tell them is that you're, the imagery is a little disturbing, but your pinky is thicker than your father's loins, and he whipped you with whips. I'm going to whip you with scorpions, and so you better get back to work. And of course, what happens? They rebel. And Judah stays loyal to Rehoboam, in a sense, really, for David's sake. That ends up being the history of Judah, is that Judah stays loyal for David's sake. The 10 tribes, they rebel, and then you can read all about this civil war that God actually prevents massive bloodshed and so forth. And so the guy that was the labor union president, Jeroboam, actually then becomes king of the 10 northern tribes. So is he a legitimate king? No. He's not a son of David. All right. Now, What ends up happening, of course, is you end up having a whole series of very, very bad kings, right? Self-serving kings, kings that actually have no interest in worshiping and serving the God of Israel. So what do the kings of the northern kingdom do? They set up Dan, farthest part in the north, and Bethel, where they're going to actually have false and idolatrous worship. And so the northern kingdom becomes known for idolatry and syncretism and all kinds of immorality, and all you have in the northern kingdom is one bad king after another, one corrupt king after another. Southern kingdom, it's hit and miss. Some of them walk according to their father David, but don't take down the high places. Others don't walk according to their father David, right? And so you just have these hit and miss in the southern kingdom. Northern kingdom is an absolute disaster. And so by the time Hosea comes along, what you end up having in the northern kingdom is a nation that is profoundly corrupt. Now, we actually know the span of his ministry. Hosea's ministry begins during the reign of Jeroboam the Second. Jeroboam the Second goes from basically 793 to 753, 40 years. By the way, 40 years under a bad ruler ends up being a really long 40 years. Okay? And so his ministry will go all through. So he probably begins somewhere, Hosea probably begins somewhere around 750 towards the last number of years, last few years of Rehoboam the Second. And then he will continue in ministry through the fall of Samaria. And we know that because he actually ministers into the reign of Hezekiah, who is, of course, the good king of Judah. And so Hosea ministers in all likelihood, roughly, give or take, from 750 to 715 B.C. 35 years. What do you think he saw in 35 years? So Douglas Stewart says, Hosea eventually prophesied during the reigns of more kings than any other Old Testament prophet. So he prophesies up in the north during the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, all kings of Judah. Jeroboam the Second, who is the king of the son of Joash, king of Israel. One commentator says the policies of Jeroboam in the north threatened his nation, for he followed the corrupt pattern begun by his earlier namesake, Jeroboam. Okay, so he ministers during a time. So think about this. So in that span of 35 years, when Hosea begins during that era of Jeroboam, Israel, the northern kingdom, was incredibly prosperous. They were actually, from a material perspective, doing well. They were expanding. And so think about Hosea's ministry begins during prosperous times, not spiritually prosperous. There's nothing spiritually prosperous really going on in the northern kingdom. But then he ministers all the way through to when the nation and the capital city is obliterated and its people scattered. That's what he sees in his lifetime. And he faithfully serves for 35 years. Now, his name, Hosea, means the salvation of Yahweh. Right? Now, we come to a sort of a big problem or a difficulty in Hosea. We'll deal with it more probably next week. But here's the question, the difficulty. Did God Really? Did God really tell Hosea, go and marry a prostitute? Okay? Now, before everybody goes, yep, by the way, being an Old Testament prophet was not an envious job. All right? Okay? So, by the way, this does create a difficulty with the book. Okay? Some believe that the command for God to tell Hosea to go marry a prostitute is unethical. Why? Well, because priests were actually told who they could marry and who they couldn't marry. And priests could actually only marry virgins. They were not allowed to marry somebody that had been married before. They were not allowed to marry somebody that had been a prostitute. And so the rationale goes something like this. Well, if God didn't let priests marry prostitutes, why would he tell a prophet to go and marry a prostitute? So now you start to have some alternative ideas. And one would be, this is it's a vision, not history. And I want to say, I think that when Gomer, by the way, why would you marry a woman named Gomer? But anyway, I don't think when Gomer is giving birth to these three children, she was like, I'm so thankful, it's just a vision. Others would say it's just symbolic. Okay, Hosea symbolizes God. Gomer symbolizes Israel. It's symbolic, not historical. I want to say that it is symbolic, but that doesn't mean it's not historical. Okay? It's just spiritual. She wasn't actually a harlot. She was a spiritual harlot. That is, she was an idolater. And again, that doesn't make much sense when you get to chapter 3 and he buys her back. I mean, okay. So Doug Stewart actually makes the suggestion that you have Gomer in chapter 1, who is the unfaithful bride, and then you have a different bride in chapter 3, who is the chaste bride. And I want to just say that I don't think that works either. Some say, God told Hosea to marry a woman who would commit harlotry, who would become a harlot. And by the way, I forget what edition of the NIV it is. The NIV kind of suggests this by not translating it a woman of harlotry, but by translating it a promiscuous woman. That is, she had the character that would lead to adultery. I just want to say that doesn't solve the problem at all. Okay. The most straightforward reading of Hosea 1-3 goes simply like this. Hosea is commanded to marry a prostitute. And then they have children. And then they separate over her continued fornications. And then they reconcile because Hosea buys her back. Okay? New Jerusalem Bible puts it very delicately. The beginning of what Yahweh said through Hosea. Yahweh said to Hosea, go marry a whore and get children with a whore, for the country itself has become nothing but a whore by abandoning Yahweh. Okay. One of the more delicate translations, of course. We'll get there. Hold your horses. Okay. Just because you're famous, because you're in the video, doesn't mean you get to talk all the time now. Okay. All right, so Hosea has two massive sections. Hosea 1 through 3, okay, and then 4 through 14. By the way, once chapter 3 is over, Gomer's never mentioned again. Okay. So you have in 1 through 3 the story of Hosea and Gomer. And so Hosea's marriage to Gomer becomes the controlling parabolic theme of the whole book. Okay? Everything ends up relating to that marriage that you see in chapters 1 through 3. right? So even though she's not mentioned again, 4 through 14, this unfaithful bride, okay, this harlot who goes back to her harlotry, just want you to think just for a second, put yourself in Hosea's shoes. You want to sign up to be an Old Testament prophet? Well, I don't really like that one. Okay, well, then take Ezekiel. Ezekiel, lay on your side and cook your food over caca. Okay. Can I at least make it cow caca? Okay, right? Or Isaiah, walk around naked for 3 years. There you go. Okay. You know what people would think of you? You're crazy. All right. Prophets had it rough. I think Hosea had it the roughest. Okay. So Hosea, Dumbrell says, Hosea is covenant centered, right? Everything revolves around this marriage covenant of chapters 1 through 3. And what happens is that the themes, the theological themes of covenant, loyal love, knowledge, and fidelity end up occurring through the whole book. All right. So, just real quickly, you have the sign act of judgment. So sign act is simply, Hosea, you're going to act out the truth of judgment by these actions. Go and marry a prostitute, have 3 children with her. We'll see next week these 3 names, Jezreel, God sows judgment. Child 2, no mercy, not pitied. Can you imagine? Hey, not pitied, come take out the garbage. These kids, I don't even know what became of them. Child 3, not my people. Okay? Can you imagine? And so the children themselves are sign acts of judgment. But then after what ends up being a terrible start, then you have a restoration at the end of chapter 1 and into chapter 2. And then what Hosea does in the book is from 2:2 to the end of the chapter, he then applies that to the Lord's marriage to Israel. And here's the stunning thing that we're going to see over and over and over again in the book of Israel, in the book of Hosea, is that it is God himself who will always take the initiative of grace to cause his people to return. They don't return just because they've had enough of their idolatry. They don't return just because they're sick of their sin. They don't return because they think it'd be a really good idea right about now. They return because God causes them to turn. This is a book of unbelievable, incredible, faithful love. And so at the end of chapter 2, the covenant's renewed with a new covenant, with vows, new names. And then in chapter 3, Hosea's marriage is restored. And what happens in Hosea 3, very short chapter, but that restoration of the marriage actually anticipates the restoration of the kingdom, a united kingdom, which will ultimately be fulfilled in Jesus Christ. And so we don't have time to review the rest. I wish we did, but we'll finish up the introduction next week. But let me just encourage you that the book of Hosea at times is going to be heavy because we're sinners. And Hosea does not hold back on exposing our sin. He exposes first the sin of the northern kingdom, and in so doing, he exposes us. Okay. That's painful. But you know the great thing about being a child of God is that when he wounds you, he heals you. Okay? And so you not only have the pain of having your sin exposed, but you get the grace of being forgiven, healed, and transformed. Right? That's really good news. So if you're completely content with where you're at, and you're completely content with the sins in your life, and you're completely content with just staying the same as you are, the book of Hosea is not for you. Okay? But if you're like, Lord, show me, help me to see. Help me to see the idols that you do know that sometimes these idols that dwell right in here are sometimes hard to see for us, right? Nobody says, hi, my name's Brian. I've got idols in my heart. Okay? We don't do that. We don't like talking about it. Hosea will expose that, but he'll expose it so that by God's grace, we're recovered, we're restored, we're renewed by the love of a God whose love for us goes beyond anything we could ever imagine. That's a glorious thing. So, yeah, you're worse than you think you are. Okay? But God's love is greater than you can ever know. Okay? So as bad as you may be, as bad as I may be, God's love is greater still. Amen. I'm looking forward to Hosea. Read it, meditate on it, pray about it, and come with a hungry heart. Let's pray. Our gracious God and Father, how we give you thanks and praise for your holy word. Father, thank you. You've not left us in the dark. You've called us to yourself. You've opened up our eyes. You've given us your word. Father, we pray that over these next number of months, we would eat up Hosea like greedy little misers. We pray that we would hunger and thirst for your love. In Jesus' name, amen.
We hope that you were edified by this message. For additional sermons as well as information on giving to the ministry of Grace Community Church, please visit us online at gracenevada.com. That's gracenevada.com.